You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 25th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So,
yes.
Some exciting news. You know, Jay, Bob, and I have been doing Alpha Quadrant 6, which is our science fiction review show. And right before the pandemic, we recorded a documentary at Weta in New Zealand. You know, the special effects company that did Lord of the Rings and other movies.
I've heard of that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
District
so
9.
That, District 9.
I Am Mother.
Yeah, that's right. And yep. King Kong, right? The
yep.
most recent King Kong.
Oh, yes.
And they did that really awesome World War I museum where the statues were giant size.
And crazy realistic.
Yeah,
crazy realistic.
Hyper detailed, hyper realistic. And like, what were they, five times normal size?
Something like that.
Easily.
Which is a lot bigger than it sounds. Because, right, you think about that, means they're 30 feet tall. You know, like the scale, that was the scale. Amazing. Anyway, we did a documentary basically all about their process. And we finally published that as an AQ-SIP. Six episode, what, 2 weeks ago, Jay?
Just about, yep.
So check that out. So we all do a lot of side projects every now and then. We bring them up, but this is the Alpha Quadrant 6 we've done on and off. The pandemic really kind of torpedoed, you know, our schedule with this because we couldn't physically get together.
Torpedo.
Yeah, we tried to do some online and they were all right, but you know, it just wasn't the same thing. Like we couldn't get in the studio together and crank out a bunch of episodes, but now we can. So we're back on schedule, putting out a video and a podcast every week.
Every Tuesday,
yep. So we want you guys to check it out. We did recently The Batman. We reviewed that movie.
And Strange New Worlds.
Yeah. Yep. So we try to hit if something just comes out, we'll try to hit it right away so that we could recommend it or not recommend it. Like we'll watch the first episode and give you an idea. Then we'll do wrap-up reviews or we'll do themed reviews, like the top 10 spaceships or whatever, you know, and how many episodes total have we since the beginning have we published, Jane? We're getting up there, right? In the 40s or something.
You know, 80 episodes.
Wow.
Oh, if you want to find us, you can go to youtube.com/AlphaQuadrant6. That's Alpha Quadrant and the number 6. Or you can go to AlphaQuadrant6.com. We have, you know, a Facebook page. We have a Patreon. So you can find us pretty much anywhere. Just look for Alpha Quadrant and the number 6.
Yeah, doing that show is a lot of fun.
I love it.
And what are we going to do? What are we going to do next, guys? How about Love, Death, and Robot review?
I already watched the whole
season.
Season 3,
baby. I'm partially through. No spoilers.
Bob, Obi-Wan literally drops the day after tomorrow.
Yeah,
so
we're going to do that.
Now, I don't know if that's going to be, if they're going to drop the whole thing or if they're going to do it episode by episode. Probably episode by episode.
Yeah,
so we'll get to review the first episode at least.
Ooh.
Then we're going to do futurism in science fiction movies. And we got to do Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Yes. Hello. We got to get to the damn theater and watch it.
Yeah. So those are the next shows that we're going to review.
Let's go right now.
Can I tell you guys something else that's going on in my life?
Yeah.
So, you know, COVID, right?
Yeah. I'm familiar with that. Yeah.
So long story short, my daughter did not get COVID over the wave during Christmas when everybody got COVID except my daughter. So
she dodged Omicron.
She did. She dodged the big wave of Omicron. Well, she got it last week, you know, a week and a half ago. So I have not literally seen my six-year-old daughter since Friday of last week because she stayed with her grandmother who also got COVID literally the same day from the same person. Keep in mind, man, COVID is still swinging out there. You know, there's in Connecticut, the numbers have been skyrocketing. It's happening in other states in the country, probably in other places around the world as well. But just be careful, you know, carry masks in your car. Make sure the people that you know and love are vaccinated. Get your boosters. Like keep it in your head. You don't have to think about it every day like we did, 2 years ago. But, you know, be smart and keep up with it.
Speaking of which, and we're actually going to talk about the monkeypox a little bit later in the show when we get to the news items. But you guys all know Mark Crislip, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah, Mark's great.
Love Mark.
Yeah. He's awesome. So he was writing for science-based medicine for years, but in 2018, he retired from science-based medicine, and now he's back, and he wrote his first
awesome.
Post yesterday. Or
Unretired, I think, like Tom Brady.
Yeah, exactly. last Thursday, he published it, and it was basically all about COVID. It's like, where are we with things right now? He's an infectious disease specialist. But you should read it. He's a very, very funny writer. Just, you know, a lot of tongue-in-cheek humor, but also totally on point. You know, he basically says, we're never going to be done with COVID. Like, COVID's never going to be over. It's now permanent part of the infectious disease background. And we're definitely in the learning how to live with it phase. But, you know, he says things so matter-of-factly, like as a specialist. It's like, we know how to deal with this. We totally 100% know how to deal with this. You have to mask and get vaccinated. Those are the two things that really work, right? Everything else is kind of nibbling around the edges. But, you know, if you masking works and getting back, and then the only way to get to herd immunity is with vaccination. That's it. We're never going to get there by natural infection. That's always been a fantasy. Doesn't, you know,
infection. But what about a hybrid of the both?
Don't
what
work
about,
that way. The
no,
problem
but really,
is,
I mean, what about the people who do vaccinate and then the people who refuse who ultimately catch COVID?
The problem is with the, as he explains, the problem with the relying on natural infections is that this virus mutates so quickly that by the time it comes around again, it just reinfects you, right? So like Omicron's really good at reinfecting people who were infected previously with COVID, for example. So it just doesn't work. You would need everybody to get infected at once with the same strain, you know, which is never going to happen. But that is what vaccination. You can't literally give everybody the same immunity all at once. That's the only way that we're ever going to really deal with pandemics like this, you know? It's just so frustrating. It's like, okay, here's the answer. And then a bunch of people refuse to do it. You know, and there's not really much we can do about it or are willing
well,
to do about
I mean,
it.
The story of our American lives right now is clear and present problems that we have a clear answer to that people just refuse to.
I know. I mean, we haven't brought up yet, you know, what happened in Texas, and it's just absolutely horrible. Another school shooting, another elementary school shooting. This was basically Sandy Hook, you know, Redux. This is just
this was the worst
terrible.
Mass shooting in quite some time. Like, we do have mass shootings nearly every day, but this was the worst in quite some time.
Basically since Sandy Hook. Yeah, totally. I mean, can you just imagine just a whole classroom of young children being mowed down like that? Just like, you can't even wrap your head around
it. It's beyond
it. Like,
horrific.
Yeah, it's just beyond horrific. You know, every time there is a big, like, national headline-grabbing mass shooting, it's interesting to see the zeitgeist in this, like, what, how are people basically responding? Like, after Parkland, there was this sense of this time something's really going to happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And of course, nothing happened. After Sandy Hook, it was like, well, this is so shocking. This is going to shock even
little kids.
The cynics. I mean, there's a little kids, but nothing happened. This time around, the vibe that I'm getting is, everyone's just saying, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
We're going to do absolutely nothing in response to this. And
pretty defeatist.
Well, you've seen the Onion article, right?
It's just practical, like, at this point.
It's getting so much coverage. There's an Onion article that they published in 2014, and the headline was, "No way to prevent this, says only nation where this regularly happens." And
awesome.
They have now republished it 21 times and only changed, like, the exact same article. They've just only changed the details of the shooting 21 times since 2014. That's the thing. A certain segment of the population sees that and goes, yeah, WTF. And another segment of the population sees that and goes, Second Amendment.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of memes we could be listing here, and, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, political discussion that we could be having, which we try to be smart about, you know, how we approach it here on the SG.
Well, we try to be evidence-based and, you know, neutral when it comes to partisanship. We're doing a very, very quick coverage here, and we probably should do a deep dive, you know, at some point soon. And we've talked about it before, but the bottom line is that sensible gun safety regulations work. They work. Mm-hmm. We have enough data to know that that is the case. But also, one of the best articles I saw, which is, again, it's one of these ones that gets republished every time there's a mass shooting, so it's still relevant, like every 6 months or so. And it compared the amount of research money that the NIH and the CDC are spending on different problems and the number of people those problems kill, right? So you have these tiny little dots of diseases with huge budgets researching them. Then you have this massive bubble of gun violent deaths and a teeny tiny budget to research it. So, like, if you take a public health approach to this, which is reasonable and rational, but also one, you know, political party is against looking at this as a healthcare issue, a public health issue. It makes absolutely no sense. There's a complete disconnect between the magnitude of the problem and the research priority that we're giving it. And that's by design. Again, that's not just by neglect or no one thought of it. That is by political design. So those are the things we need to be talking about. We should be doing the science. We should be doing evidence-based, rational. And the other thing is, you know, 80, 90% of people want these regulations. They're not even unpopular.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the most frustrating thing, is that we lack the political will in the face of overwhelming public support. Something is broken there, right? That's what's so frustrating
system.
About it.
Yeah, the gun lobby. That's what's broken, is that the interests of politicians, they're placing them over the actual lives of children.
No, absolutely. Yeah, our democracy isn't working when the public can't exert their will through their elected representatives, right?
Yeah.
We get reminds of that every time one of these things happens. Like, and of course, nothing's going to happen because I just really hate the defeatist attitude. And that's why I embrace it. I'm not happy with the overall response that I'm seeing in public of nothing's going to happen, there's nothing we could do, because it's self-defeating, right? Even if it's true, it doesn't matter.
Well,
I'd rather go down
really
swinging.
It doesn't really make sense given the administration we're in. Like, we can do something.
Well, I think, honestly, I think the thing that we can do is vote. I don't think we have the political people in place now to do anything, because you need 60 votes in the Senate basically, and we don't have that. And if the public really wanted, if we really wanted to do something about this, it would require people voting on this issue and, you know, getting off their butts and voting. And the problem is people forget about it in 3 weeks and they go on to the next thing, you know.
And that's also incredible. That's a very slow process.
Yeah. Like, I think we can be doing more right now. And part of that is speaking up. It's putting pressure on the people that we already voted into office by just plastering them with the message that they are failing their constituents, and by acting locally as well. Because, yes, we know that the Second Amendment is this big Goliath that David is facing, but we can affect change at the local level. We can make sure that the states that we live in have the strictest laws possible, insofar as they don't encroach on the Constitution. I mean, we can make sure that our neighborhoods are safe. That's what we have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, I keep going back to, for me, Sandy Hook was a real, real watershed in many ways, because that was the time I really, really felt, well, of course, something's going to happen. I mean, we're talking 20 some odd 5 and 6 year olds slaughtered. Yeah. I mean, it was really egregious from that angle, and it didn't happen. So then I'm thinking, what will it realistically take for something to happen? And I don't have an answer to that, because I can't imagine what it's going to take.
For something to happen.
This isn't going to do it. Sandy Hook didn't do it.
All right. Well, we're not going to solve this problem today, unfortunately, but it is a conversation that we need to keep having. So, guys, let's go on with our news items. All right, Kara, so we've been talking about COVID, but what about this monkeypox I keep hearing about?
Yeah, I don't know if you guys watched a recent episode of Last Week Tonight, but he sort of intros it with like, this is going on. And monkeypox, I'm not going there. I can't deal with this right now. He's like, we're a bit fatigued. I'm not going there. And I think it is an important conversation to have, especially amongst, as you mentioned, the background of COVID. What is monkeypox? Should I be afraid of monkeypox? What's going on? Because we're hearing it on the news. And I think we can go one of several ways, but we can go one of two extreme ways, which is the same way we went in the early COVID days. This is happening somewhere else. It doesn't affect me. Even though we've seen a few cases spreading around the globe, I'm not concerned about it. Or we can go the other direction, which is freak the F out. And I don't recommend either of these directions. I think it's probably somewhere in the middle.
And to our credit, though, I, you know, remember and have listened back at this, at the our very first reaction to COVID was be concerned, but don't panic.
Right.
That was our first. And then, of course, it was, yeah, we probably should have been panicking. But but initially, we were like, yeah, you know, this, but definitely don't ignore it. Be concerned about this. Keep an eye on it. It's too early to panic. But I think we're in the same place with the monkeypox, but go ahead and give us the overview.
I think we probably are. I think you're right. But for individuals who hear, I mean, there's a reason that John Oliver was like, I can't deal with this right now. Like, don't tell me that there's a monkeypox infection going around the globe right now. So let's talk about what this is. This is not a pandemic. This is not an epidemic. Maybe an outbreak is a good term to use.
It's an outbreak. There's a very specific definitions, as you know, that WHO uses: outbreak, epidemic, and pandemic. This is at the outbreak stage now.
So COVID
was at the outbreak stage at one point. Oh, go ahead.
Any pandemic starts as an outbreak. You are correct about that. So let's talk a little bit about what monkeypox is and what we know about it. So monkeypox actually is sort of a misnomer. It was identified in 1958 among lab monkeys. So we first kind of got wind of this idea of this disease because lab monkeys showed symptoms of it, but it's not a monkey disease. They're not the natural host, the natural reservoir. And it's very likely that individuals who catch it, now it is a zoonotic infection, but it's very likely that they're catching this as a spillover from rodents. We haven't really pinned down the exact core reservoir, but it's very likely that rodents are the ones carrying monkeypox. The first cases in humans were in the 70s in the DRC. We actually saw an outbreak here in the US in 2003. I don't remember that. Do you guys remember a monkeypox outbreak in the U.S.? I mean, it happened.
No.
I remember reading about it, but I wasn't aware when it happened.
Right. Okay. So that happened. I think there were they prairie dogs, I think, that were sold from a pet store. And those had come from Ghana. We're seeing that, you know, most of the spillover events are happening in Africa. And there are sort of two regions. There's the West African endemic version of monkeypox. And then there is the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, remember that's formerly Zaire, kind of cluster of monkeypox. Monkeypox is a pox virus. It is similar to smallpox. It's not the same thing as smallpox. And here's some of the good news. We're going to be doing some good news, bad news today. Some of the good news is that it is generally more mild than smallpox. It is generally less deadly. The symptoms are generally less severe. It can be quite dangerous, though, especially for individuals who have compromised immune systems, like many viruses. So children, older individuals, pregnant women. It can look kind of like chickenpox. One of the, you know, there are multiple symptoms and they happen in a very particular order. You get these flu-like symptoms, fever, headache, and then you start to develop, and swollen lymph nodes, and you start to develop this blistering rash that happens after that. It usually takes about 4 weeks in total, about a month for the entire course, although it can be shorter. By the time the pox actually show up, you've already usually been showing these other symptoms. The deadliness is low. And one thing that I think people are getting confused in their coverage is that whereas the DRC cluster of these viruses can have a case fatality rate of upwards of 10%, the outbreak that we're seeing right now is actually the Western Africa virus, and it has a case fatality rate of closer to actually under 1%. In practice, it has been slightly higher, 2-3%, but that's usually because of poor healthcare, not because the virus itself has that high of a fatality rate. So with proper treatment, it's very unlikely that individuals will die from the type of monkeypox that is currently circulating. When we look at where it is in the world, we have some, you know, it's, it depends on if we're looking at confirmed or suspected cases, but the majority of them right now are in the United Kingdom, Spain, and Portugal. We're also seeing cases in the teens in Canada and the Netherlands. And then we've got two cases here in the US, two in Australia, two in Denmark, kind of down the line. And these are all within the last several days, going back to earlier this month, but these are updated all within the last several days. There is some idea, we still don't know where the first spread took place, but there's some idea that it likely took place in Spain because that's where the virus was first being tracked. It could have been at a rave. It could have been at it's like a pride parade because early reports pointed to the virus spreading within the community of men who have sex with men. So we actually are seeing some parallels to some of the early panic that we saw with the HIV/AIDS epidemic, where there's some misunderstanding about how it's spread, about who can catch it. Monkeypox, anybody can catch monkeypox. If we are seeing a cluster within a particular community, it's just because that happens to be a community that was exposed. Monkeypox does spread through particles in the air, but it doesn't spread as quickly or as easily as COVID. And that's something that's important to remember. Monkeypox is not COVID. It's not a coronavirus. It's a completely different type of virus. Mm-hmm. Although it can be meaningful for us to make comparisons like we did early on with COVID when we talked about the flu, because it's what we know and it helps us find an established jumping off point, it is important that we remember that just because it's a virus, there are a lot of viruses out there. Remember that science or fiction we did on viruses? Didn't we all miss it?
Yeah, how many there are? Yeah.
Yeah, like how many infect? Yeah, it was a bananas number. It was like orders of magnitude more than we thought. One of the things that's important is about finding that balance, because what we don't want to do is say, well, we know about monkeypox. We know what it is. We've dealt with it before. We have actually, by the way, smallpox vaccines in our stockpile. And smallpox vaccines are like 80 to 85% effective against monkeypox because they are so similar. Unfortunately, the original smallpox vaccine that we do have stockpiled also has like some pretty nasty side effects, which is why when the CDC first grappled with whether they wanted to inoculate the entire population or vaccinate the entire population, they decided against it because the risk wasn't worth the benefit at the time because there was no real risk of catching smallpox since smallpox has been eradicated. But we've always had a concern about bioterrorism, which is why we've maintained these vaccines. Since then, a newer vaccine has been developed, so that's really promising. It was developed only like a few years ago, right? Yeah, 2019, Jynneos, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. And it has a lower side effect profile. And we also have an antiviral that was developed for orthopox viruses, so smallpox and monkeypox it works on. It's called Tecovirimat. And so we have all of these different treatments available to us. So in some ways, this is completely different than COVID because we already know about it. It's a known entity. The problem is we've never seen a spread like the spread we're seeing right now. Most monkeypox outbreaks have been in either West or Central Africa, and they've stayed in West or Central Africa. If they have spread around the globe, it's been, you know, one or two people, and then they've been contained very readily. So there still are some questions. Has there been any sort of mutation? Is there something different about the way this virus is spreading? So we really want to do exactly what we were talking about before. We want to be cautious, but we also don't want to panic. Collect more data, know that we have appropriate prevention strategies and treatment strategies on deck if we need them, but hopefully we won't need them. One last thing I want to say before kind of we open it up is that there was some good reporting in the Washington Post recently. I think it was just yesterday. The headline was, "As monkeypox panic spreads, doctors in Africa see a double standard." And I think it's an important perspective because when we say, should we be worried? Well, yes or no. We're very often talking about, should we in the West be worried? But this monkeypox outbreak did not just happen in specifically in Nigeria. It's been spreading for years. It's not actually new just because it's new to those of us in the West. And, you know, the fact that we have these stockpiles and the fact that we have these treatments available really does, I think, lead to the question of why aren't we doing more to help it in its, or to stop it in its tracks where it's happening, to prevent these global outbreaks. So food for thought there.
Yeah, I mean, totally. This is like Ebola, the same thing where, you know, we need an international rapid response team for any outbreaks like this, no matter where they happen. First of all, just for, you know, equality, we want to...
Yeah, just from a humanitarian
From a humanitarian point of view, it doesn't matter who you are, we want to stop an outbreak. But even if we're being selfish and being Western and privileged, whatever, the best way to protect everybody in the world, including ourselves, is to stop these outbreaks at the source where they happen. We don't want Ebola to break out. We don't want the monkeypox to break out. And because every time they do, then it creates new opportunities for more mutations to happen.
Absolutely. Zoonotic infections are not just humanitarian problems. They are economic problems. They are public health problems. They are geopolitical problems. And to pretend like they don't play a role in all of these different contexts is to be utterly naive and isolationist in our response, and ultimately it's going to bite everybody in the ass.
Yeah, I mean, when I wrote about this, I said that this is, you would think that COVID was a wake up call, and it's only sort of was, but my fear is that the world is getting kind of COVID fatigue, and before we really learn the lesson, and maybe the 1-2 punch is necessary, like a near miss. It's like, yeah, even when COVID is running its course and we start to, to adapt to it and live with COVID as the new normal, we have to remember it's not going to be 100 years before the next pandemic. That's just not the world we're living in. We're living in, there's decade. Too much international travel. The human population itself is just, we're approaching 8 billion and we are encroaching upon nature in such a way that zoonotic infections are more likely to jump to humans. And not only is COVID the new normal, pandemics are the new normal. We are living now in pandemic world, and we have to adapt to that. We realized with that first really massive outbreak of Ebola that we were not ready for it. And then we said, okay, we have to fix this. And then we only halfway did. But we didn't fully fix it. And then COVID happened. We got caught with our pants down. I mean, magnificently. And, and we said, okay, now we really have to fix it this time, right? And now we got the monkeypox. And, the WHO sounds like they're on top of it, and that sounds good. And they say this is containable. There's no reason to panic. Yes, it's an outbreak, but this is at the containable stage. But, the world's got to get its shit together, and we're not to the degree that we need to be.
Yeah, you use that term caught with our pants down. And I literally was thinking while you were talking, I was like, that's the thing. We're not caught with our pants down. We see it coming a mile away.
No, we're
every pandemic
down,
started as an outbreak. how are we not more prepared? We know it's going to happen. And this is one of those examples that we always talk about on the show where it's like, we have the tools. We have the knowledge. We have all of the things that we need to either prevent, mitigate, or treat. And yet we continue to walk down the street and whistle going, it's not going to happen to me.
What are the roadblocks specifically?
Political will.
Political will, financial it. Roadblocks. It's really, that's what it comes down to. Where do we want to put our money?
But the thing
How
is,
do
it's
we
not,
want to prioritize?
It's not really a money issue because it doesn't cost
it's not that
much money, and it's a good investment. We would save so much more money. It really is just political will because we're just politically dysfunctional. That's the bottom line. There are international organizations like the World Health Organization, and there are national organizations like the CDC who contribute to this. And it's just a matter of giving them the resources and the priority, et cetera, to that they could set up the infrastructure. I remember when the Ebola outbreak was happening, the characterization was we're building the firehouse after the fire is
raging. Right.
And you can't do that with infections. I think that what COVID really, that what I hope comes out of COVID, and again, it's still kind of a mixed bag, is that we realize that pandemics are a worldwide global problem that we all have to solve together. You cannot think locally when it comes to a pandemic by definition.
You
can't be isolationist. You can't be, my country first. You can't do any of those things because it doesn't work. Whatever your philosophy or ideology or politics are, it doesn't work. You have to treat it like a global problem, which means it's everybody's problem everywhere. And we need to treat it that way. And if we don't, we're going to keep getting bitten in the ass by these pandemics. So is the monkeypox going to be the next one? Probably not. But if it isn't, there's something else coming down the line.
Absolutely.
And as getting back to Mark Crislip, as he noted in his recent SBM article, it's like COVID's not the worst thing out there by a long shot.
God. No, it
there
is not.
Are, even if just the respiratory viruses, there are things that are much worse. Like if we get hit with a bird flu pandemic, it would be much worse. You know, imagine COVID, but with like a 10% fatality rate. That's
we're going imagine
a
something
birth
like
right now in the country, aren't we?
Yeah.
Something as infectious as COVID, but as deadly as Ebola.
I forget. I mean,
yeah, I mean, we, you know, the United States just passed what the million deaths.
Million.
I mean, imagine if at this point that was 10 or 15 or 20 million, which easily could have been the case if this was a nastier virus, which it absolutely could have been.
It's a game. It rewrites everything at that point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And something, I mean, one of the points that we didn't make about monkeypox, and it sounds like a negative, but it's sort of a veiled positive, is that the symptoms are really obvious with monkeypox. The unfortunate thing is that they're delayed, but in infectious diseases where there is a rash associated with it, it becomes very easy to identify the infected. And it becomes a little bit easier for treatment due to that. You don't need necessarily to be doing certain, you don't need to develop certain types of tests to see if somebody has the disease. You can identify it point blank.
It's got its own marker.
Yeah, it's got its own marker, which can be beneficial, but the problem is it's delayed.
One thing on the good news is the technology, and Moderna's already working on a monkeypox specific vaccine, mRNA mm-hmm. vaccine. So again, we'll have another vaccine that we won't get to enough people. All right. Let's move on. We have a great interview with a NASA scientist coming up later in the show. And we have a couple of space news items, starting with you, Jay. You're going to talk to us about NASA's recent plans for Mars. They've basically fleshed out what in more detail their plans for going to Mars. Give us the update.
Yeah, NASA released a good block of details on their first human mission to Mars. So here are some details. So NASA said that the mission will be 30 days. So 30 days at the planet. Of course, the total mission is going to be way longer than that, right? I think it's like 500 days round trip. Mm-hmm. Two astronauts will be on the ship in orbit while another two astronauts are planned to go down to the surface. This is kind of, you know, like they had one person in the orbiter when we went to the moon with the Apollo missions. So they planned to double that. And NASA has asked pretty much anyone who wants to give them feedback on their mission planning, feel free to do that. The new deadline for that feedback is on June 3rd, which I find interesting. You know, they want to hear from the public if anyone has any good ideas or, you know, just give them, you know, your feedback on what they're doing.
Jay, how would you feel about going to Mars and then not stepping foot on Martian soil? And
you know, I thought of that actually, Steve. I was
you have to
about,
think of that.
I've thought of it a couple of times. You know, just I watched a few documentaries about the Apollo missions and, you know, the astronauts that get picked. And you think, you know, people were asked, you know, you're going to be left in the essentially the command module, and you're not going down to the surface. But I will say this, Steve, that the work that they do there is very important.
Of course.
Critical.
You would think, though, if they're all the way there, you know, Mars is so much farther than the moon, you know, that they would be like, well, we'll let everybody go down, you know, but it's complicated. It's expensive. It's dangerous. Somebody has to stay back.
But here's one difference, Jay. So, I mean, the astronauts were in rotation. We know that, you know, during the Apollo mission. And there was a lot of competition to get one of those spots. If you were going to be in the command module, there was a good chance, based on what you knew at the time, that in a later mission you could go down to the moon.
Right.
They didn't know that Apollo was going to get cut short. If you go all the way to Mars and back, I doubt you're going again because you basically used up your lifetime of radiation exposure. And you're probably not going to go back, you know?
Yeah.
So it's different in that way.
That's true. I mean, I guess to some people, it's still an honor and still
of course.
an incredibly exciting thing to do.
And I'm sure that's what they would say. It's like it's better than being somebody left back on Earth, right? You get to go to Mars, even if you're only going to be in orbit. But anyway,
Steve, I thought you were going to say, this is what I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to say that if you're left in the command module, there's a pretty good chance that the astronauts that went down to the moon surface were not going to make it back. You know,
well, the first time that was true. Collins was prepared to come back by himself, right? I mean, he knew that there was a good chance that he would be making a 3-day trip back to Earth by himself, and he was ready to do that. you know?
Have to psychologically prepare yourself for that?
Yeah. Oh,
boy, it's awful.
Training, psychologically, everything. You know, it was a very real possibility. Hmm.
So they said, Steve, that they're thinking late 2030s, early 2040s for the first Mars mission, for the first crewed Mars mission.
20 years, basically.
So I know we talked about this previously on the show, but Bob and Steve mentioned it already. We talked to two people from NASA last year at Nexus, and they said that, you know, speed is of the essence for many reasons, like getting people to and from Mars as quickly as possible. And of course, one of the main reasons is the dangerous radiation that people will be exposed to, because we also found out that there isn't, like, you know, shielding and things like that there are really going to be significant. So they said we need to get the astronauts to Mars as fast as possible to minimize the amount of radiation that they're going to have to deal with. Now, gravity is a big player in this, too. When we go to Mars, the lack of gravity is going to be a problem. The astronauts will be in microgravity, which essentially means that they're weightless for months at a time. This means that they will have muscle and bone loss. And once they get down to the surface of Mars, guess what? They will be in a weakened state. The one-third Earth gravity on Mars will still feel like a ton of gravity to them. So one idea NASA had that they're talking about right now is, in order to handle this issue, that they'll have the astronauts live in a rover. This will let them get around, you know, do science and acclimate safely.
Science. It'll
be kind of like, they'll be like the people from WALL-E, you know, those people on the ship. Throwing around. So once they're in good enough shape to put on the spacesuits, if they're strong enough and their endurance is at the right spot, then they can go outside and do more science. But in the beginning, man, they're going to basically have them be lying down, doing more exercise to beef up so they can put those suits on. So before the astronauts get to Mars, there will already be approximately 25 tons of hardware and supplies and, you know, equipment and everything poised for their use. You know, when they arrive in orbit around Mars, their ascent vehicle will already be there 100% ready to go to fly them down. So they'll be leaving probably when all of this stuff has already been put in place. And NASA knows that their current plans are definitely likely to change. I mean, you know, they're talking about it right now, because they're going to be pouring much more time into consideration into these missions. Right now, what they're doing is they're saying that the Habitat spacecraft that will be able to bring them to and from Mars' surface will be, it's going to be a hybrid, going to be a chemical and electrical propulsion. Preparation for these future Mars missions, of course, are significantly, I mean, utterly influenced and hinging on the success of the moon missions. Once we get to the point where things are going very smoothly on the moon and we get it and we have all of this stuff in place, then we could start sending equipment to Mars to prepare for humans going to Mars. But the pathway, you know, to pave that road to get there, it's a huge amount of money and work, which I find utterly fascinating. You know, you go through this list and you're reading about, you know, just all the different things that they've realized that have to be, you know, have to come into reality at some point within the next 10, 20 years.
All right. Let me ask you guys a question. This is a math question. It's a hypothetical question. So let's say you are the CEO of a company and the company's business requires two fleets of vehicles to do deliveries or whatever. A smaller fleet and a bigger fleet in terms of the size of the vehicles. But it's the same number of vehicles and they each drive 10,000 miles a year. So same exact number of miles driven per year by each fleet. Fleet A is comprised of vehicles that get 10 miles to the gallon. Fleet B is comprised of vehicles that get 20 miles to the gallon, right? Now, your accountant says, we have enough money to upgrade one of these two fleets, but not both. And because of just advances, you can swap out the fleet that gets 10 miles to the gallon for one that gets 20 miles to the gallon, or the one that gets 20 for one that gets 50. Which would save more money, going from 10 to 20 miles per gallon or 20 to 50 miles per gallon?
Again, and we're only concerned about money.
And the same number of vehicles in each fleet.
10 to 20.
Same quantity.
Same number of vehicles and miles driven in each fleet. So
this
all
is like
other
a backgammon
things,
question.
10 to 20.
All things being equal except 10 to 20 versus 20 to 50.
Because 10 to 20 is a 50% gain versus 20 to 50. That's a smaller ratio.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. We're just looking at the total gain.
Well, what do you think?
Game.
Just give me an answer. Just give me an answer.
I don't know. I have to do the math. I can't do the math that fast in my head. So,
what's your gut?
Sorry.
What's your gut tell you?
I don't like these gut questions.
Come on. Why else would he ask it if it wasn't 10 to 20?
Yeah, it's 10 to 20 is my gut, but I
But he said 20
wrong.
To 50.
But the other one's way bigger. 20 to 50.
Yeah, 20 to 50 is more than double.
But so do you have half your fleet dragging ass in the last century, or do you get both of your fleet like slightly better? Steve, I changed my mind. I think you want to go 50.
20 to 50.
Yeah.
Well, because you're saying it's 50-50. So but I don't care about the ratio. In my head, this is how I'm calculating it, and this is probably wrong. 0.5 times 10 plus 0.5 times 50, or 0.5 times 20 plus 0.5 times 20.
Yeah.
And you're going to get better gas mileage if you upgrade the higher fleet.
What do you think, Jay?
I don't know. My gut is for some reason telling me 10 to 20.
So the people use two heuristics when confronted with these questions that are both wrong, right?
So, and we just demonstrated
Yay,
both of them.
Shortcuts yeah. don't work.
So there's only two choices, so some of you are obviously right. But
exactly.
So one is to assume, like to do a linear calculation to say, well, 10 to 20 is the difference is 10. And 20 to 50, the difference is 30. So that's obviously a much bigger difference. So that's the one you should prefer. Evan, you were essentially stating the ratio bias. You know, 20 is twice 10, 50 is more than twice 20. So that should be better, right?
That's what it sounds like, yes.
Both of those are wrong. And this is the linearity bias over, that's like the umbrella cognitive bias. You know, I can't resist cognitive biases, right?
We noticed.
But not only is the strict linear bias wrong, actually even the ratio bias is often wrong. It obviously depends on context. So Bob is correct. 10 to 20 is a much bigger advantage. It's very counterintuitive though. And the other thing that's happening here is you're thinking of it backwards. Our instinct is to think about how much of a gain you're making rather than how much of a decrease of a loss you're spending. Yeah. So think about it this way, Kara. You can think about it this way. When you go from 10 to 20, you're halving your fuel. The 20 is already at half. So it's impossible for it to have as much of a gain as the 10 to 20.
But I wasn't even looking at it like a change.
But that's the question.
Right. But I was literally looking at it like if half your fleet, 0.5, is operating at 20 miles per gallon.
Your approach is you're looking at the miles per gallon. You should be looking at the gallons per mile.
That's
the logical fallacy.
Okay.
Yeah. Because you should not be looking at like how far you're getting on a gallon, but how many gallons are you spending to go that 10,000 miles? And
then why don't we term it that way?
We should. People argue that it should be miles per gallon. I mean, it should be gallons per 100 miles or something. You know,
right.
Make it a meaningful, because then it is more intuitive when, you know what I mean? Because then your instincts are aligned a little bit better with the reality. You still might think linearly, you know, but when you actually think about it in terms of how many gallons of gas you're saving, you would have to go to zero just to equal, you know, you basically have to have infinite miles per gallon in order to equal going from 10 to 20. Because you're already spending half at 20. So the potential savings is less. So you would save, for example, for every 500 gallons you save from going from 10 to 20, you're only going to save 300 from going from 20 to 50. Let me give you another example. And this is also like designed to be a little bit mind-blowing, but I know you guys are prepared for it now. Also with driving. Let's say you increase your driving speed from 40 miles per hour to 60 miles per hour. How much would you need to increase your speed from a starting point of 80 miles per hour in order to save the same amount of time on the journey? Would you say 100 miles per hour or 120 miles per hour?
Oh, I see. What's the What's the equivalent of?
Yeah. I have a very hard time doing these.
60 is the same as 80 to
100. I'd say it's a higher number.
How much? So you think about how much time do you save by going from 40 miles per hour to 60 miles per hour? Now, how fast would you have to go in order to save the same amount of time if you were starting at 80 miles per hour?
Probably 120.
Yeah, tell me if I'm wrong, but I remember always being told that, like, sort of at 60 or beyond, you're sort of peaked.
Mm-hmm.
Optimal.
Like you're not going to save any.
Right?
Yeah, like you're not. No, not because wind resistance, but just like because of the way that the math
because
works
of
out,
diminishing like, returns.
Yeah, like you're not going to get there any faster if you go 90.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the answer is 240 miles per hour.
Wow. Right. Yeah. Like you're never going to get to 240. Yeah.
Right. So if you follow a linear thinking, you would say 100. If you follow ratio thinking, you would say 120. But in reality, you need to be thinking exponentially, which gets you to 240. So the part of the linearity bias is that we underestimate the advantages of improving things at the low end, and we overestimate the advantages of improving them at the high end. So that works for both of these examples that I gave. So like when you go from 10 to 20, that advantage just blows away anything you can get beyond that, right? And when you go from 40 to 60, that gives you such an advantage in speed that you can't make it up unless you go like 240 miles per hour beyond 80. So the part of it is the thing that with this example, what people don't take into account is that you're getting there a lot faster when at 80 miles per hour as your starting point. There's a lot less room for improvement.
Yeah.
And at 40, so like when you're, if you're, you know, calculating a journey, you really want to avoid the choke points. You know, even if it's like it would be, you would save much more time taking back roads than speeding along going the highway slowly, and then getting into bumper to bumper. That the time you lose when you're going super slow vastly outweighs even, you know, a relative decrease in speed overall. You're right. So once you get north of 60 miles an hour, the thing is at 60 miles per hour, you're going to get there reasonably fast. There's just not that much room for improvement. So when you go even faster, you're talking about for even a 100-mile journey, like just a couple of minutes. Like it becomes negligible. Right. The time savings becomes increasingly negligible when your starting point is already pretty high.
Unless you're an ambulance.
You shouldn't speed. That's why ambulances don't really speed. I don't know if you paid attention.
No, what they do is they get the benefit of the cars moving out of their way.
Right.
Yes. That's all that they get.
So they make it up at the low end. They're not waiting in traffic, but they're not speeding. Yeah.
And so to be fair, Stephen, I only want to clarify, because this isn't just a conversation we're having, but people are listening and learning from us. Some things in life are linear.
Absolutely.
Like we have to be clear that this bias only applies to these specific situations and others them.
Yes. I mean, or you could say that we have a linear bias, whether it's true or not. It's true sometimes, but even when it's not true, we still stick to our linear bias. We just tend to think linearly. And
we grasp it more easily.
Yeah. And so,
because I think some of the things that are really fundamental to our evolution are linear.
Mm-hmm.
Like the heuristic has served us in so many ways.
That's why we have that heuristic.
Yeah, generally speaking.
Yeah.
You can survive life in a linear way of looking at things for the most part.
It just bites you in the ass sometimes.
Two brontosaurus burgers are twice as good as one.
that's exactly right. And we think of that the bias comes from, like, if I have one bookshelf of books and then I add a second one, I have twice as many books. That's correct. That is linear. Mm-hmm. So of course, Kara, that's why we have this heuristic. Maybe it's that in our evolutionary milieu, as I love to say, that there wasn't a lot of things happening that were geometric, right? But now we live in a civilization that deals with stuff like, we have Moore's Law, where we have a geometric increase in the processing speed, basically, of computers, the number of transistors on a computer chip, and over like every 18 months to 2 years, and that has produced just unbelievably massive increases in computing power.
Is that still
power.
Holding true? Did Moore's Law taper off, or with computing power?
Not yet. I don't think
we're still on the course.
It's just that it's different. I mean, there's a complicated answer to that. It's still not linear. It's
definitely
just that there's other aspects of computing power that are being focused on. It's not all about the central processor, you know, like adding cores. Does that really? It's just different. But the industry is maintaining the overall performance increase one way or the other, because that's what's best, you know, for the industry and for sales. The benefit of understanding the heuristic biases of how your brain works is that you can fix them, right? You can think, so how, for example, do we do this? So here, just getting out of yourself and thinking, oh, wait, is this a linear progression or not? And just sort of add new modules to modify your heuristic, but you're doing it sort of consciously. And this gets to what you're saying, Kara, it's always going to be like amazingly more helpful to pick the low-hanging fruit rather than push for incremental advances at the high end. You always deal with the lowest end first. You're going to get so much more bang for the buck at the low end than you will at the high end, because we vastly underestimate the benefits of shoring up the low end. And we vastly overestimate.
Yet we never apply this to our economic principles.
I mean, economists do, but even sometimes they get it wrong when they fall for this, you know, for this heuristic. But generally people don't. Like intuitively, we don't do it. So, but there's a lot of people who are like not expert economists or whatever, who are the heads of companies and who make decisions, who make purchasing decisions and business decisions based upon this faulty linear heuristic. We also run into this. We talk about this a lot in our book. We run into when we're trying to extrapolate future progress, because from both ends, because we think of progress as linear, just intuitively, and we also think of problems as linear, and problems are not linear either. So you get diminishing returns there. Like, for example,
batteries.
The
last 5%.
That last 5% could be 10 times as hard as the first 95%. Right. So like with speech recognition, Kurzweil in the 1990s predicted that by like the early 2000s, we would have cracked speech recognition. And we got to like 95%, which sounds great, but that still means 1 in 20 words is wrong. And it got stuck there. And it took 20 more years to like really get to the point where it's more like at the greater than 99%. And then we ran into that with self-driving cars. We were like, okay, yeah, we're going to be all riding around in self-driving cars by the early 2020s, right, now. And that's not happening because that last few percent, which is important, you know, not having accidents, it turned out to be an order of magnitude harder than the first 95 to 98%. So when you approach problems, first of all, you have to just be aware of that, but it also means you should just grab that 95%. You know what I mean? And make sure that you do all of those things first. That's why, like, my approach to the energy problem is like, let's grab the 95% of every option we have and not try to push the last 5% of any one option where you get into incredibly diminishing returns, right? It's the same thing. Yeah. If you try to go 100% solar and wind, it's a lot harder than just, you know, letting it get to its natural sort of equilibrium point where we're picking the low-hanging fruit. Anyway, so it's really an interesting bias. And like, once you really wrap your head around it, it does help you think about a lot of things. Make sure you're calculating things the right way. I love the gasoline one because it's like you're thinking of miles per gallon, but you really should be thinking of gallons per mile when you try to do comparisons.
It doesn't help that the question is couched.
I know. I mean, but that's the but that's the way we think of things.
Reverse engineer.
That's the world we are interfacing with, right? So anyway, good to keep that in mind. And it comes up in a lot of places, like more than you would think. Okay, let's move on. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time?
Oh my God. All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. So,
I love it.
You guys have any ideas? What do you got?
Something underwater, kind of. I sense a sloshiness to the noisy.
It sounds like a web of wires being plucked.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. Yeah, exactly. So Charlie Ross, you guys know Charlie, right?
Yeah,
Charlie.
He hit my finger.
This sounds Charlie Ross, very longtime patron, good guy, good friend, said this sounds exactly like the sound you get when you bang on a cable that is under very high tension.
Right.
Am I right?
Take the screwdriver, right? They use it for sound effects in Star Wars.
Pew pew pew. Charlie represents probably about 50 people who wrote in the exact same thing. This is not correct. Eric Engman wrote in, first guess ever, I think this sound is made by a spring in a tube. This is not a spring in a tube. But that is, I have heard a spring in a tube, and I know exactly why you say that, because that sounds like that to a certain degree. I have another guest by Milo Silvestri. He said, "Hi guys, almost a beginner into the skeptics world. Thanks to your podcast. It will be now and forever part of my life, and I will make it part of my daughter's too." That's great to hear, Milo. So this week's Noisy is an underwater recording of ice cracking due to temperature dilation.
Aha, see, underwater.
You were both correct in the fact that you used the word water.
Excellent.
Another listener named Jody Paul said, "Hi, Jay, listening since 2015. Thanks to you all. My five-year-old Lori guesses it's a flamingo. I would like more explanation about that one. My seven-year-old Alistair guesses it is someone shooting lasers at a baddie."
Yeah, that's right.
And then Jody guessed it's some kind of tropical fish. I want to know more about the flamingo. That's what I want to know. Now we have another listener named Chris who said, "Hi, Jay. I heard this Noisy while I was mowing my lawn. After hearing the Noisy, I ran inside to compose this email. This Who's That Noisy sounds to me like the gameplay from the video game Tempest." My God, you are correct. It does sound like Tempest. There are definite parallels to the game Tempest in there. You're not correct, but that was a wonderful guess. I'm going to read one more, and there is no winner this week. A listener named Ben said, "Ben here from
Dover."
Steve.
Ben is the Frenchie from Japan. He says, "This sound pattern is a classic, but I think this time water seems involved."
Yes, thank you.
We have a big structure under the tension that is making vibrations, the ice sheet on the water, and the very famous cable are things of the past. For Who's That Noisy, I would say. So my guess this time would go to an underwater communication cable being laid down on the bottom of the sea. So I will tell you this one has to do with water. This sound is the sound that you hear when water is coming out of a swimming pool and lapping up against the metal gutters at the side of the swimming pool that collect the water. This is a sound that a lot of people are familiar with because these are typically the way public pools are built. And with the right position of a microphone, you can get a really cool sound like that sound. So take a listen again. So this is water going into the metal gutters that collect the water on the, along the pool.
Wow.
You hear it now?
Oh, yeah.
It's remarkable how it sounds like so many other cool things. That was a great Noisy. All right. So thank you so much, Jeff, for sending that in. I have a new Noisy from a listener named William Grew Mullins.
What? Did I hear that right?
Yes, you did.
William Grew Mullins?
Mullets.
Mullins.
No, mullets, like the haircut.
Mullins.
Oh, Mullins.
All right. I want you guys to be specific, please, with this Noisy. You'll understand when you hear it. Okay. So, please be specific. Don't be unspecific with this one. That's all I ask. If you think
unspecific,
yes. If you think you know what this week's Noisy is, or my God, people, if you have heard a Noisy that you think is cool, you found it on the web. It could be something from your life, at work, at home. As long as it's interesting and doesn't sound like white noise. If it sounds like this, don't send that to me.
Okay. How many of those do you get a week?
a lot. You would be amazed. People have this long wind up. I had this unbelievable machine at work that, oh my God, I've been listening to it for years, and I've been thinking I really got to record that for Jay. Let me record it for you. Here's the recording. I'm like, it's just white noise. But please send me these Noisies at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, there's one more thing we got to discuss. So,
yes.
The Arizona dates, there's four shows that we have planned in Arizona. We have decided to move the dates to a later time this year. It's very, very likely that these dates are going to be moved to November. There are lots of reasons behind this, but one of them, and the most important one, is that COVID is coming back, and we feel that in 2 months, things could be so dicey that we would be canceling these shows outright. So it's safer right now when we have a lot of lead time to delay the shows. We're thinking that November is basically the next time frame that works for us and the venues. So we will be picking probably the second weekend in November. That's what it's seeming like right now. But I will be emailing everyone that has purchased tickets. Everyone will be told exactly what's going to happen. We're sorry about this, but we've been dealing with the pandemic now for over 2 years, and we know how it goes. And a wave is coming, and we don't want to, you know, be brushing up against a hard hitting pandemic where nobody can show up to these shows. And you know, there's a lot of time and money invested in these things by us, so we have to be careful. So we will be moving them. Tickets are still available. We will be giving you the firm dates next week. But for now, just know if you're a ticket holder, you will be told everything that you need to know. And if you are interested in buying tickets, feel free to go ahead and buy them. But the dates are going to be changed to probably that second week in November.
Yeah, there, you get a full refund, no questions asked, up until like 7 days before the event. So yeah, there's no risk there. If you're obviously for the tickets that we're selling for the private shows, again, 100% refund if necessary. But also you will automatically, if you want, you'll be... your tickets will apply to the later dates. This is what we had to do in Denver, you know, which was at the beginning of the pandemic. The same thing, and it worked out well. So yeah, we do this reluctantly, but we really had no choice. Now we're going to have to delay it until a later date. Probably better, actually, to be in Phoenix, Arizona in November than July anyway, I'm thinking.
True that.
Just from a temperature perspective. All right, thanks, Jay. All right, guys, we have a named out logical fallacy this week. I don't think we've had one in a couple of weeks, a little bit. I'm trying to do a lot of them, but we get a lot of questions where people say, what fallacy is this? And I can't resist those. So this one comes from Chris, and Chris writes, hey, gang, I'm a longtime fan of the show and really appreciate your hard work. I was trying to figure out what logical fallacy this one is. Recently, someone mentioned the Amber Heard trial, and someone else said that the world is heating up and there is all this gun violence, so we shouldn't be paying attention to a celebrity trial. It feels like an either or, but it doesn't feel quite right. Is there a specific logical fallacy for someone saying you don't have the bandwidth to pay attention to several things at once? Keep up the good work. I love my signed book and have purchased several as Christmas presents for friends and family. Chris. Well, thank you so much, Chris. So what do you guys think about this? What's the logical fallacy?
Did relative privation come to mind?
Yeah, relative privation. So Amber Heard for Evan, I think.
For Evan.
Yeah, I've lived under a rock.
Yeah. Johnny Depp, Amber
been,
Heard.
Yeah, been, yeah, they're having a very public, nasty separation with Johnny Depp. I haven't been paying that close attention either, but I know what's happening. You know, it's kind of all over the mainstream
all
media.
All over Reddit.
Lots of claims of abuse, and it's really ugly. And
it's ugly.
Public.
Yeah. So, obviously garnering a lot of attention. But is it a fallacy to say... we shouldn't be paying attention to that because there are more important things to be paying attention to.
Steve, and help me with this, because I feel like there is probably a fallacy that could say that. And mm-hmm. like, you know, Bob, you started to mention relative privation. Yeah. There's others that we could probably point to. But is the question really, is in this particular situation it a fallacy? Because I would say no. And you and I have kind of argued about this before when it comes to things like, why are we putting money here when we could be putting money there? And my argument is often, because it's a zero-sum game, there's only so much money. Mm-hmm. But often your argument is, no, but there might be enough to go around in this situation, which is sometimes the case. So I feel like this is a great example of those times where like informal logical fallacies can apply, but also it's very context dependent.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the very nature of informal logical fallacies mm-hmm. is that they're informal because they're context dependent. The formal logical fallacies are always fallacies in every context. They're fallacies by the inherent design, right?
Right, of the basic always, breakdown of logic.
They're always not valid. The logic always fails, whereas the informal logical fallacies, which are most of the ones that we're talking about, you know, in terms of critical thinking and making good arguments and policing your own thought process, et cetera, they're very context dependent. Like the argument from authority is a great example of that. It's actually legitimate to cite authority when appropriate and in an appropriate way, but you can also abuse that. It's really the abuse of authority that is the fallacy. So here, let's just talk about the logical fallacies that are potentially relevant here, and then we can probe the limits of those fallacies, the context portion of it. So Bob brought up relative privation, and I do think that's the main one, that if there is a potential fallacy in here, that's the main one, and which is saying that something is not important if there's something else that's more important, right?
Right.
But of course, there's, right. there's always something else more important.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't nullify.
And it doesn't nullify things that are still important unto themselves because it's relative to something else. It doesn't make any... The relativeness is irrelevant. Again, unless you are in a very narrow context where it is literally a zero-sum question.
Yeah.
If you're saying, oh, should we do A or B? Then you can make a comparison because you're literally making a choice between A or B. But other than that, you know, it is, again, a fallacy to belittle someone's concerns or legitimate concerns because you can think of a more important fallacy.
Which happens all the time with, like, oppression Olympics.
Yes, right.
Right? It's like, wait, this person's suffering doesn't exist simply because this other person is suffering more.
Right. Right. Bob and I, without mentioning names, you know, Bob and I were recently in an email exchange. I won't go into details, but it basically was that the whole argument was something along the lines of, that guy has no right to complain because my friend had his legs blown off in Afghanistan.
Right.
Like,
right.
It was like the most irrelevant argument you could possibly make. But also it was just 100% relative privation because I know somebody who had something horrible. Nobody with any lesser problem can ever complain about anything. It's just a ridiculous standard. And and the thing is, it's used, that kind of formula of the fallacy of relative privation is used to deny or diminish someone else's legitimate concerns or complaints, right?
Right.
It's just not fair to do that to somebody.
But I could also see that the reaction, and not in this situation with the legs blown off in Afghanistan, but the reaction to this person who wrote the email, who said, you know, these school shootings, this stuff that's so, like, so important, and yet people are really caught up in this, like, Amber Heard thing, the reaction would be the false equivalence. Well, they're not the same thing, and maybe we shouldn't be comparing them as if they have the same weight.
Right.
Like, that's the problem with relative privation, is you can take it to such an extreme that it's no longer meaningful.
Yes, exactly. But let me give you another example, relative to the recent shootings. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a basketball coach, you know, who was in a press conference, and they were asking him questions about basketball.
Oh,
and
he said,
I'm not going to talk about basketball. I'm going to talk about why kids are being killed in schools.
Yeah.
So he's making a choice to use his time on the stage to say, let's focus on something that's way more important. And that's fine. He can make that choice to use his platform to focus attention on something that he thinks doesn't get enough attention. Not again, it doesn't matter relative to basketball, because you will talk about basketball at other times. And this that's just
right
a very much in the moment. Yeah, it's a very much in the moment thing. You know, like there is legitimacy to that. Like, when people's attention is focused on something very important, bringing up trivial matters, you know, whether not that they're not important or never important, they're just relatively trivial matters, may just, like, read the room. Like, it's just not
tone deaf.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's not what people are thinking about now, you know.
Yeah, we have to do this all the time on the show. We have to say, what is going on in the world right now when this episode is going to air? Is that remark going to seem insensitive because that's not the topic of conversation?
Yeah.
But it's, of course, against the background of what's happening in the world.
Yeah, sometimes it would be weird if we didn't talk about something.
Right.
To ignore
Right.
Be inappropriate.
Right.
Yeah.
So the other thing that might be lurking in there in terms of as a logical fallacy is a forced choice, right? And that's where I think it gets the either or question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you have to be wary of that too. It's like, we can't do A because we're doing B. It's like, well, we can do both. Mm-hmm. That's perfectly fine. There's 8 billion people on this planet. We don't all have to be doing the same thing. And we can go through our day giving an appropriate amount of time and attention to different things, but still go about our life and do the things we need to do, and maybe even, you know, engage with other people and whatever. Like, life, you still have to live your life. It doesn't mean that 100% of our attention has to be focused on the single most important thing. Sometimes it does. If there's a zombie apocalypse, we're going to be talking about the zombie apocalypse and pretty much nothing else, right? That's appropriate. But those are unusual circumstances. Now, you might argue that we're in one of those circumstances now, and that's fine if that's your argument. If you're saying, I personally can't really think about anything else right now because I think this is more important. Now, the other context here that you may apply is, what should the mainstream media be giving their limited time and attention, right, space, physical space,
yeah,
to? Should they be writing columns about Amber Heard, or should they be focusing on, you know, more important issues of the day? And that's a different question, because then it is a zero-sum game, because there's only so many inches in the, you know,
exactly,
you know, that doesn't really apply to online anymore. But it's still, there's only so much space and above the fold kind of attention that they can give, and they are prioritizing. So there's a that is a zero-sum game priority thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where what are you going to put in front of people's, your readers' faces? And that's a judgment call, a value judgment you're making about what is the most important story to be talking about today. And that is, that's the editorial policy sort of issue. And you have to put that into context of the outlet as well. If you are a celebrity gossip columnist, you're going to talk about Amber Heard. You're not going to talk, you know, that's what you're going to talk about, right? That's fine. If you're a serious newspaper that talks about the news of the day, this is pretty much the news of the day, you know?
I guess I'm curious too about, and because I the list of informal logical fallacies is so very long. I'm curious too about, it seems like some of the miscommunication or that feeling that's arising in the writer's email of, I talked about Amber Heard. I think that was the framing, right? I talked about Amber Heard. My friend said, how can you possibly be talking about that when
someone mentioned Amber Heard? It wasn't them. So you said, someone mentioned Amber Heard. Someone else said, we can't talk about that. There's so much gun violence going on.
Right. Like, that's not valid. And it almost, there's almost, and I don't know what informal fallacy it would, but the assumption that they know the reasoning behind their behavior. Because, for example, this person could be watching the Amber Heard stuff and talking about it because that's palliative to them, because they're so overwhelmed by the trauma of the other things that they can't talk about those things, not because they're not thinking about them.
I agree. And I think sometimes when I encounter arguments like that, 9 times out of 10, it isn't a serious discussion about priority and limited attention, whatever. It's usually just a way of virtue signaling a little bit. It's like, I'm more serious than that. Like, I'm, you know, I'm not going to sully myself talking about celebrities when there's real important things happening in the world. So I think you have to be careful not to create that vibe when you do that. You know, you're kind of shaming people for paying attention to things that you are deeming trivial. You know, it's very easy to slip into that when you're making that kind of argument. You have to be very, very careful. And you're right. You don't know what, there's the fundamental attribution error, right? Where we assume other people are doing that. You're talking about that because you're a trivial person, as opposed to maybe this is how you are dealing with all the stress. You know, for example, like there's a situational factor that's going on. Yeah, there's a lot of layers here.
The devil's advocate that I would say to that, and it's not to minimize what you said because I completely agree with you, is that I think there's also something to be said about boundary setting for your own mental health. And so it's one thing to say you shouldn't be thinking about that. I mean, that's not okay. But to say I'd prefer not to talk about this right now because it feels like it's minimizing what's going on in the world, that's perfectly okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, and then the email was framed as, we shouldn't be talking about this, not, I personally don't feel like I can pay attention to this right now because I'm distracted by young children being slaughtered in their classroom. Yeah, that kind of has my attention for the moment. I can't really, that's fine. You're right. I absolutely agree. If somebody's making a personal statement about their choice, that's 100% fine. As soon as you generalize it that we should be doing this because it's the correct thing to do, it's the morally right thing to do, then I think you're being judgmental, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, I think we beat that dead horse. Thanks, Chris.
Sure.
All right, guys, let's go on with our interview. We are joined now by Dr. Naomi Rowe Gurney. Naomi, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Great. And you are a planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and Howard University. And we wanted to talk to you tonight about the James Webb Space Telescope, because your job now is going to be very soon working with with the James Webb. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so what I do, I'm a solar system ambassador. So what that means is I kind of rep the solar system for the James Webb Space Telescope. Because everybody thinks when they think of the James Webb that it's just going to be looking at distant galaxies and stars and other solar systems and exoplanets, but actually a lot of the time is going to be spent looking at our own solar system. So I'm here to kind of tell people about it and let them know about it.
What would be, like, you know, some of the more important things that we want to look at locally?
Yeah, so there's loads. James Webb can look at everything from the smallest asteroid all the way through to Mars and Jupiter, like really bright objects. The only things it can't look at in the solar system are anything that are towards the sun. So, you know, that big umbrella on the back, the big like silver thing,
yeah.
That's like the size of a tennis court. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that blocks everything from the sun and also the earth, the heat from the earth, and make sure that everything on the other side is nice and cold. So it's important that we don't look at the sun.
Yeah, that would just fry it, right?
Yes. Or if we looked at earth, that would also fry it. You know, anything that's like super hot, because we're looking at something called infrared, which is basically like heat instead of light. It is light as well, but if you go far enough into the red, you go into the infrared, and that means you're looking at heat. So all those security cameras that you use at night, they'll be looking at heat of humans and animals and things. And we're using that same technology to look at the stars.
We know our solar system relatively well. I mean, how much further, how much more is there to learn about our nearest neighbors?
Well, there's loads. I mean, everything that we do outside of our solar system, we can help by doing things in our solar system. Our solar system is kind of like a big playground that we can use, a big sandbox that we can use for experiments that stop us having to kind of assume things that are further out that we can't actually go to and touch and see really close up. So all of our planets we can see very clearly, whereas the ones in exoplanets in other systems we can't see because they're so small and far away. So all of the things that we see here are, yeah, experiments for things we see out there.
Naomi, when the whole thing was happening, like it was a nail biter for me. And I'm not even at NASA, like, knowing the blow-by-blow. Like, was it scary when all, like, what was there, like, 300 different stages of deployment that had to happen? And what was that like, you know, hearing about it every day? Was it a scary thing, or did you feel very confident it was going to go well?
Yeah, it was pretty scary, but also exciting. I knew that, you know, they'd taken a lot of time to do a lot of testing, and it was still nail-biting, but I had a lot of confidence in the fact that it was going to be successful. And I'm glad that I was correct. But yeah, you were talking about all of those like failures that could happen. So they're called single-point failures, which means that any one of those things breaking meant that the telescope wouldn't work. And it had more single point failures than any other mission of this size. So including things like Mars landers. So Mars landers usually have about 100 single point failures, and James Webb had over 300 single point failures. But now we don't have many. We've only got the normal ones in a normal mission. So all of those unique ones have gone past now. So we've been successful in all of that new science.
So when that last one clicked green, did everyone freak out? Was it like a celebration moment, or was it more of just like a sigh of relief? What was it like?
Yeah, it was a massive sigh of relief, and everyone celebrated. But unfortunately, because of COVID, a lot of the things that we did were remote. So, for example, we were meant to go in on Christmas Day to be able to celebrate together on the launch. But we ended up all staying at home. And so I was in my pajamas in the morning of Christmas Day with my dog, with a Christmas hat on, celebrating in my front living room. So very different, but still exciting.
Neat.
So can you give us an update on where James Webb is right now? It's not quite 100% functional yet, right?
No, correct. So it's in the place where it's meant to be. So it's rotating around this L2 Lagrange point that's 15 million kilometers away. But it's not completely, it's deployed. So there are three stages of what we call commissioning, which is what we call the stages that it takes to get to where the telescope is a working telescope and all of the instruments work. And we can then use it for science. So the first stage was our deployment, launch and deployment. So that was all of the exciting stuff. So all of the unfolding and, you know, bringing that boom down and making it look like what it is now physically. And then the second stage was aligning all of those mirrors. So making it so that all the light goes into the right places on the instrument. And that's over now too. And that was successful. And now we're just beginning that third stage, which is where we commission the each scientific instrument. So there are four instruments on board, the MIRI, the NIRSpec, the NIRIS or FGS, and the NIRCam. And all of those instruments need to work properly for the telescope to work properly.
So in your particular area of research is looking at Neptune and Uranus, correct? Even before, you know, the James Webb.
Yes.
So which aspect of James Webb are you going to be using?
Yeah, so I am a massive fangirl of Uranus and Neptune. They are my favorites and have been for a really long time. And it's mostly because we haven't really seen anything about them since Voyager in the 1980s. So we haven't been there and we haven't really been able to even look at them properly. We've had ground-based instruments look at them, and we've had Hubble look at them and Spitzer and all those space-based telescopes, but we haven't been able to go there since Voyager 2 in 1986 and 1989, which means there's so many unanswered questions about them. And they are a whole class of planet that we haven't really explored yet. So we've looked at Jupiter and Saturn. We've looked at the rocky planets like Venus and Earth and Mars. But Pluto, we haven't looked at this last class of planet. Yeah, exactly.
Not a planet.
We've even been to Pluto, and Pluto's even further away. Yeah. So we just missed them. They've been
That's
neglected.
True. Interesting. Yeah.
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 What's the official name of that class? Of are they ice giants, or is there,
yes,
what's the, that's the
ice,
okay,
giants,
that's,
yes,
ice giants, yeah. So which of this the James Webb components will be you'll be using, and when, more importantly, when do you get access to it? I'm sure there's a ton of demand, right, for the James Webb. Are you waiting in line?
Yes, so at the moment there's something called the GTO, or the Guaranteed Time Observations. They've already been tentatively scheduled for this next year coming. And Uranus and Neptune are on the list, both of them, for this coming year. So we'll be able to see a lot more about them. And we're using both the NIRSpec and the MIRI instruments. So that's in the near-infrared and the mid-infrared. And the one that I'm most interested in is the MIRI instrument, the mid-infrared instrument, because it's got the longest wavelengths. And that means it looks at thermal, so that all of that heat. So the near-infrared one looks at heat, but it's only like the beginning of like the heat part of the spectrum. And then MIRI looks at the rest of the heat spectrum. And that's the most exciting for us planetary scientists, because it's looking through the clouds instead of looking at the clouds. So we can get a little bit more about what the what's happening underneath with the circulation and the temperature, and try and figure out all of these mysteries that the Uranus and Neptune have.
How deep can you look with MIRI?
With MIRI, we can look down to around 2 bars of pressure. So that means 1 bar is kind of the pressure of where we are at sea level, the pressure of sea level. Yeah. That's 1 bar. Yeah, so we can't really liken it to Earth apart from with that, because it doesn't have a surface. So we can't say it's, you know, like 20 kilometers above the surface, because it doesn't have a surface. It's just gas giant. So it just, as we go further in, you just get this gas compressing and compressing until it becomes lots of crazy weird things because of the pressure and the heat that's happening inside. So we use pressure.
So what's the latest thinking though on the core of Uranus and Neptune? Is it kind of like metallized hydrogen, or what are they thinking, especially compared to Jupiter?
Yeah, so it's still completely unknown, but and they're just making educated guesses with the very small amounts of information that they have about it, mostly from Voyager. They found something very interesting in a lab recently called super ionic ice, and that's water ice, so H2O, that has been squeezed so much that it becomes this weird state that it's not a gas, it's not a liquid, it's not a solid, it's something completely different. And it's black and hot, and it's like a sea of hydrogen atoms that are like surrounded by like a lattice of of oxygen. It's very strange and cool.
Oh, wow.
So it could be that, but we don't know. One person even said they might be rock giants rather than ice giants. Ooh. And that's a topic of an entire paper. So who knows? We really don't know.
Have they been able to take just random pictures outside of our solar system just to see? Are they like? I know that they're doing things about focusing the mirrors and all that, but has there been any pictures that have just been out and did we see anything cool?
They have been taking pictures mostly of asteroids and star systems, etc. so far. But as I said, they're still in commissioning, so they're just picking very convenient objects to look at so that they can calibrate and check that everything's working correctly.
Yeah, I read that they were tracking an asteroid with it.
Yes.
And I was wondering, like, would we use James Webb for asteroid prediction, you know, like course predictions and things like that?
We could use it to target known asteroids and known comets and Kuiper Belt objects out near Pluto and moons of the solar system as well. So anything like that. And actually, I'm on the team that's doing the commissioning with the moving objects. So that asteroid that they looked at, asteroid Tenzing is what it's called, named after Tenzing Norgay, who was one of
Sherpa.
The first people. Yeah. One of the first people to go up Everest.
Cool.
Yes. It's named after him. And that was the first moving object that we looked at. And yeah, I'm part of that team that is helping with the data analysis of that and checking that everything's working, which is really exciting.
So when can we expect really pretty pictures of Uranus and Neptune versus James Webb? I mean, that's
colors,
what most people
okay?
are thinking.
Right.
Yeah.
Something other than a blue marble.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Oh my gosh. I am asking the same thing, honestly. Yeah. We think that the Uranus observations are going to be soon, but the Neptune ones will probably be around this time next year, just because of we have to check that the planet is in the right place. If it is anywhere near the sun, obviously we can't look at it. So we've only got these certain windows in the year that we can look at each planet. So, Uranus should be this summer, hopefully, and Neptune will be maybe next summer.
Are you going to be taking a look at the moons of these planets as well, like Triton, or really just focusing on the planets themselves?
Yes, we are looking at moons. Probably not looking at moons in this first stage for Uranus and Neptune. We're not focusing on them anyway. They might show up in some of the images, which is going to be fun, but they're not the focus. But we are focusing on Titan, which is one of Saturn's moons. Yep, very exciting moon because it has an atmosphere. Yeah. Yep, very similar to Earth's, except it's made of methane rather than our nitrogen-based one. And that's very exciting. And they're also looking at Enceladus and Europa.
Ooh.
Two of my favorites.
Yeah. They're really exciting because they might have oceans. Yeah, exactly. Yes, so that's going to be good. And we're also going to be looking at small moons of Saturn. And there will be some moons of Jupiter that will be being looked at as well.
All right, I'm going to ask the question that everyone's thinking, of course, so I'll just do it. What is the ratio of scientists who pronounce the planet Uranus and others that pronounce it Uranus?
Oh my God.
I think it's very geographical, you know. I think a lot of English people say Uranus and a lot of Americans say Uranus. But I'm trying to change people's minds on Uranus because it's a great icebreaker.
I love it.
I thought we were going to say something else.
It really makes people listen and it makes kids laugh. And why wouldn't you want that? So, yeah. And I spent the last 4 years studying the gases of Uranus.
Awesome.
So I'm very used to used to the ridicule. So it's great.
My son's going to love this podcast.
Yeah. But it's hard. Like when Bob basically asked, how deep are we going to dive into Uranus?
No, don't even. I was looking at some pictures. I don't know if these are real or not, but I was looking at like Hubble compared to Webb, right? And I guess they're showing like the same piece of you know, space. And I don't know if this is real, though. Like, I don't know if this was like a simulation on how much sharper it is or whatever. But do those pictures really exist, or are those just, you know, showing you
projections,
what it is, but it's not real?
Yeah, so there was an image going around, or two images going around, that were Spitzer compared to Webb. Mm-hmm. And that's a real one. And it's a real comparison of the same field of sky. And that's a really great picture because it shows how much more signal that we're getting, and all of the details that you can see, and the resolution is much better. And it's very, very exciting, especially for people who are looking in the mid-infrared, like I was talking about before.
Yeah, I've seen that picture. Those two pictures, and oh my God, it's the difference between looking at something completely blurry and looking at something that's in focus.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, and yeah, they haven't even started yet. So it's really exciting that that's just, you know, that's just like they turned it on and pointed it at something convenient. So imagine what they can do with time and investing the science into it.
Now, as high res and amazing as James Webb is, and it certainly is, it's a marvel. But when you think, you know, when you like think about, oh man, if only, or I can't wait until, like, what kind of resolution, what kind of things would you love to see that even James Webb just is nowhere near having the capability of discerning?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, all of the questions that we got for the James Webb Space Telescope came from the Spitzer Space Telescope. So until we answer the questions with James Webb, will we know what questions we have for our next generation
science.
Space Telescope?
That's science.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. How we don't know what we don't know.
How about that for an answer, Bob?
I like it.
What would you want to look at that's even better than the one that we're just celebrating now? Like, come on, Jake.
Bob's already.
Bob, let the James Webb settle in, man. Let it do its magic.
It has settled in, but I can't help but thinking, as awesome as that is, what can our grandkids, what are they going to be looking at? I can't help but thinking.
They already have planned that next one, or they're planning it. It's like the Louvois / like Habex, and it looks like a giant James Webb.
Oh, gosh.
So scientists are just as impatient as you are.
Okay. Well, I kind of doubt that because I'm thinking about like solar gravitational lenses. So that's kind of. You know, many generations down the road, but let's look at an exoplanet 100 light years away and look at the continents. That's the kind of stuff I dream about, but you know, but James Webb's good too.
No, but seriously,
I am serious.
For studying the outer planets, right? I mean, I think a probe is going to give us better
true.
Images.
You're right there. That's true.
Than any telescope near Earth. So I guess what I'm asking is, when are we going to probe Uranus?
Oh,
Steve.
Well, actually, you mentioned this. We had something called the planetary decadal. And that means that the National Academy of Sciences announced kind of what the priorities of science should be for NASA. And NASA usually follows it. And they said that the priority mission, the flagship mission of the next decade, should be a Uranus orbiter and probe. So you won't have to wait long.
Oh, my goodness.
Awesome. Yeah, because it has been a while, like, you know, since Voyager. I mean,
exactly.
So I would imagine that would be on the short list.
Naomi, will Hubble help James Webb, like, find stuff? Like, is Hubble going to be turned into kind of like, let's have Hubble look first, and then we'll have James Webb come in with the big guns?
A spotter telescope?
Yeah.
They're actually very complementary. So it's not going to even act as its sidekick. It's going to be its partner. It's going to be looking with it because Hubble looks in the visible, so in the same light that we look in. And it also looks in the UV, which is even further, like, towards the blue. And then it also looks at a shorter range of the near infrared. And so that means that we can look at a planet in this entire range, and that's really exciting for scientists because lots of different things happen in each of the bands, all the way from UV through to the mid-infrared, and it means that you can deduce lots of different scientific conclusions and do science better with more wavelengths. Hubble's not dead.
I know, the Hubble has lasted way longer than I thought it was going to, you know.
I know, it's 32? Is it 32?
Yeah. It would be.
Still
right,
kicking.
90.
It's the same age as me.
Oh, my. No.
Yeah.
You can't have those problems with web, though. It's getting there.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty far away. It's a bit too far away to go for a servicing mission, yeah.
Do we know how long it'll last?
We know how long it could last. So when it went up, the ESA, so the European Space Agency, were in charge of, and is it Airbus? I can't remember. They shot it off and launched
it. They killed it.
And
they did so well. I know where you're going. Go ahead. I'll let you finish.
Yes. They did the best job ever. We love them because the fuel that we needed to get to where we went was minimal. And that means that we have over 20 years of fuel. And that was the major limiter to our time frame. And now we just have to wait for one of those single point failures to fail. And that's probably it's going to happen before the fuel runs out. So yeah, we're looking at maybe hitting 20 years.
That's fantastic.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It was a 5-year mission, 5.5 years, maybe, maybe 10. And now it's 20. Yeah.
So Naomi, what's your biggest hope for the James Webb with regard to your research specifically? Like what is it that you think in 10 years you'll be looking back and go, this is what we discovered?
Yeah, so my PhD was using the Spitzer Space Telescope, and that kind of asked the question, as Uranus spins, why is it changing in its brightness? Like, what's happening? And we can't answer that question until we have James Webb. So my specific research will gain a whole paper about why it was changing when it was spinning, hopefully. And that's going to be a big deal. And then hopefully that kind of thing is going to ask more questions that can only be answered with these missions, hopefully, that are going to happen soon. And so in 10 years' time, I'm hoping that there'll be a mission on the way to Uranus and Neptune to answer those questions.
Awesome. Well, Naomi, it was wonderful talking with you. We love talking to scientists who are excited about their work, and we're all excited about James Webb. Maybe once you do get that next paper out, we'll have you back on the show to tell us what you found.
Yeah, that would be great. This is great fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys remember the theme from last work, which one is bigger? I like that so much, I decided to use a similar theme this week.
which one is
older? Which is older?
Okay.
Here we go.
Chance.
Yeah. Item number 1. The first cities predate evidence for iron use by about 5,000 years. Item number 2. The first dinosaur walked the earth 40 million years before the emergence of the first true trees. And item number 3, the first firearm was invented about 900 years after the first steam engine. Jay, go first.
The first cities predate evidence for iron use by about 5,000 years. I mean, can I ask you what your definition of a city is?
That's a very good question because the experts don't agree on what the definition of a city is. There's no very specific operational definition, and it actually is also a little bit depending on context. But the first generally agreed upon cities, we'll say.
I mean, I could imagine that is possible. I'm just, I'm thinking about early cities. I mean, iron, I wouldn't say is a requirement, but I don't know. I just feel like, at that point in a civilization when they're manipulating iron, it helps. Anyway, there's a lot to unpack there. Let me just move forward now. The first dinosaur walked the earth 40 million years before the emergence of the first true trees. What I do know is that sharks predate trees, and there might be a dinosaur version of a shark.
I love that statement. Yeah.
Right? I mean, it is pretty provocative.
A dinosaur version of a shark.
Why wouldn't
I love
there
that
be?
It's a sharkosaur. You know what I mean? Like, it's, they're basically dinosaurs right now. You know what I mean? Like, they're that old. But when you say dinosaur, Steve, you're talking about
the clade dinosaur, the evolutionary
the clade.
To blave. All right, so
the only thing that saying something is a dinosaur would refer to, probably.
Gotcha. All right.
It's an actual dinosaur.
That one does have a technical operational definition.
That's why when I think about the creatures that were living 40 million years before trees came around, I don't know if that was the time of the dinosaurs. So that's another one. That's one like, whoa, I have to really put a lot more time than I have right now. And then again, the last one here, the first firearm was invented about 900 years after the first steam engine. I think that one is science. Wait, 900 years? Yeah, you see? These are good, Steve. This is really, really good. I don't have a toehold anywhere on any of this. The first firearm was invented 900, almost 1,000 years after the first steam engine. Wow, now I'm doing a complete reversal on that one. All right, I have to make up my mind.
Yes, you do.
I'm going to say that I think that the dinosaur one is the fiction because of all the reading that I've done on dinosaurs, I don't think they existed that long ago because trees are incredibly old.
Okay, Evan.
Okay. Cities versus iron use, 5,000 years, huh? Yeah, because I think Jay kind of hit on it, the definition of cities, it can be kind of nebulous. So I think you could make a case in which that would be a span of time that would be 5,000 years. The other two, I'm having problems with both of them. Dinosaurs walking the earth 40 million years before the emergence of the first true trees. True trees, I think, is, you know, what kind of you have to know there. What were there, like proto trees before true trees, something like that? So that gets very messy. And then the first dinosaur walked the earth, you know, so what, crawled out of the muck and technically walked. And it was 40 million years before the emergence of the trees. What the hell did they eat? I mean, if not each other. So that's the problem I'm having with that one. But I'm also having a problem with the first firearm invented about 900 years after the first steam engine. That sounds that sounds reversed to me. I mean, when was the first firearm? You define firearm. We think 900 years after the first steam engine. So what, the steam engine? There was a steam engine in, if the first firearm was in the 12th century or something like that, the first steam engine was in the year, what, 300? 400? Is that right? That can't be right either. Both 2 and 3 are fiction, both.
But which one is more fiction?
I don't know. I guess I'll go with the firearm one as the fiction. I just, that seems totally backwards to me. Like you just flip-flop those two. So I don't see it.
Okay, Bob.
The thing is, just because when you say first steam engine, that doesn't mean people are riding around in the steam engine. There could be a toy steam engine. And I think there might have been evidence of a toy steam engine that for some reason the Putzes didn't think they could scale it up. You know, like there were like wheeled toys with wheels before there were vehicles with wheels, kind of a similar idea. So that one actually makes perfect sense to me. And so I think that's what's happening here. And the dinosaur one, yeah, people think of dinosaurs from 65 million years ago when the meteor hit, but they were around for, well, you know, what was it, hundreds of billions of years. So I just don't know about the emergence of trees and the distinction between true trees, but I'm going to say that one. So I'm going to say that one, I can kind of make that work in my head as well. The cities and the evidence for iron use I'm much more unsure about. So I'm just going to, by default, say that one's fiction because I think the other ones might be true. Yeah.
Wow, you guys are spread out.
Yeah, Karen, that helped you.
All over the place.
Okay, so I'm going to take them in order. I definitely think that hunter-gatherers decided to cluster before they were working with iron. That one just seems reasonable to me, that individuals were clustering and learning how to pool resources long before they had really sophisticated tool use. And so, I mean, there's still tool use, but long before they were honing, like, I don't know, whatever. I just think that people were settling down into what we would determine to be a city, which is a cluster of people. It's a cluster of people who are no longer nomadic. So yeah, that one seems reasonable to me. The first dinosaur walking there 40 million years before the emergence of the first true trees. This one's very hard for me to buy. I think trees are incredibly old. Dinosaurs are old, but they're not that old. True trees. Yeah, even true trees. I think what we call trees are true trees, whatever that means.
They're trees that sprout true fruit.
That one true gets trees. Me. The firearm and the steam engine, the thing about this that I feel like, who freaking knows, honestly, it's so arbitrary, is the choice of terms. Firearm. You did not say gun. You said firearm, which, like, fire. What is a firearm? It's something you can hold in your hand, I assume, that blasts something. I feel like we've had that technology for a really long time. And the first steam engine, it's funny because you said, Bob, you said people weren't riding around in it. I don't think people ride in the engine.
No, you know, using a steam-powered
vehicle.
Steam
power.
Right, but I didn't go to train when you said first steam engine. I went to, like, just power to power something.
Yeah, to make a conveyor belt turn around or something.
Right, like that could
just
be super
old. Yeah, that was
just
an example I was giving.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it doesn't have to be for like a vehicle.
No, but large scale used to do work and not just a toy.
Totally. But it didn't have to be a toy either. It could have been to do work. It could just have been to do really old work.
Depends on the
definition
of
it could have been really rudimentary.
Yeah.
So I don't know. To me, it's like those could be stretched back. They're probably way older than we think.
Exactly.
And who knows which one comes sooner. But to me, the one that's really bugging me is the dinosaurs. Oh, yeah, Steve does. is the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are not as old as trees. No, there were trees. There were trees when dinosaurs were around, even the first ones.
I agree.
Well, at least two of us are wrong.
Guess there's no reason not to take these in order since you guys are all spread out. So we'll start with the first one. The first cities predate evidence for iron use by about 5,000 years. Bob, you are alone in thinking that this one is the fiction. The rest of you think this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Bob. The first evidence for iron use goes back about 5,000 years before the present. Experts debate about exactly what constitutes a city. It's more than just a cluster of people, though, Kara.
Buildings.
Because that's a town, right?
A town.
So when does a town and a village become an actual city?
I didn't know you were making that distinction.
Oh, yeah,
I thought
absolutely.
You were making, like, settlement versus non-settlement.
No. City was, you know, was specific. But so it's got to be urban in some way. The question is, what are the criteria that we make a town an urban center? Is it density? Is it total population? So some people think you need to have urban infrastructure, you know, not just number of people. But, you know, using all of these various definitions, there's pretty solid agreement that in the Middle East, specifically Jericho, which goes back about 10,000 years, was probably the first city. And then soon after that, there were other, like in India and elsewhere, there were other similar. Yeah, they probably crossed over the line to be called an actual city. They were an urban center and not just a town or a village. So that's 10,000 years. So yeah, so there's a 5,000 year difference. Of course, this was during the Bronze Age. You know, remember, bronze was just perfectly fine. Bronze is an excellent material for tools, for weapons, for armor, for lots of things. The problem with bronze was not the quality of the bronze itself. It's actually superior to iron, right? Remember this, bronze is superior to iron. It's you know, it's easier to cast. It's not as brittle. It doesn't erode with water and oxygen like iron does. Iron rusts. Bronze does not rust. Bronze is a superior material. What killed bronze was that you had to bring together two materials, copper and tin. And if you didn't have both of those supplies, which usually don't come from the same place, flowing at the same time, you couldn't support a bronze economy. And so when that collapsed, they used iron to sort of as a lesser metal, but it was good enough. It was easier to easier to source. It was harder to work with. It needed a higher temperature and everything, you know, lots of reasons why it's harder to work with. But by the time they were able to reconstitute the bronze economy, they started to invent steel. And then once they figured out how to make iron into steel with the carbon and everything, then it was game over. So that's really, so anyway, this was during the Bronze Age that they,
to
that
this
they,
day, even steel
yeah, to,
rules.
To this, yeah, yeah, to this day. But even like, remember when I was looking at Bermuda, the bronze cannons in the 1800s were superior to the iron cannons because they survived the sea water better. Anyway, so that one is science. Let's go to number two. The first dinosaur walked the earth 40 million years before the emergence of the first true trees. Evan, you are correct that true trees is important there.
Yeah, I think this is the fiction now.
The first the first dinosaur, total bonus points if anybody can tell me what the first dinosaur species was.
No, Comarctus?
Sorry.
I have no idea, but I think it was around 250 million years ago.
First stop, first.
Nyasasaurus Parringtoni.
Yeah.
Right? Nice. Believed to be the earliest dinosaur that ever lived. Again, it's like it's close to the demarcation line. If it wasn't the earliest dinosaur, it was related to the first dinosaur, you know, at the same time. It's very, very close. Just first described in the 1950s, but not formally described in literature until 2013, actually. So dates to approximately 243 million years ago.
Way off, Kara. Way off.
Right? And then dinosaurs go back 243 million years. So the next question is, when did trees emerge?
Before that.
Let's see. So the first tree appears during the Devonian period. You guys, if you know your periods, you should either there be celebrating or crying right now. Between 350 and 420 million years ago. Yeah. So trees predate dinosaurs by a couple of hundred million years. Yeah, a long time.
Good job, Kara.
Yeah.
Good job, Jay. You said it first.
But it's hard to think back that much time. Again, like the deep past is like a mishmash unless you really know the periods, know the epics, and can organize them in your mind in some way. I was hoping to get you with the true trees because certainly tree-like plants existed on land at that time. But there were, remember, the proto-trees or like a different branch of things that looked kind of like trees, but they didn't have the same structure as trees, as modern trees do.
So you added the word true in there just to mess with us?
No, it's accurate. Yes. This is when the true trees emerged, but it was, I was hoping that you would say, oh, we threw that in there because, you know, it was not the true trees until later, whatever, you know, you would think
that's
what
threw me off. Yeah.
You know what came before the true trees?
The fake trees.
Like fungal trees, like huge mushrooms.
Yeah.
Dominated.
And we talked about this too on the previous show. The previous things that were tree-like had they didn't have a core. It was like a circle of trunks, right?
That
line died out. All right, all this means that the first firearm was invented about 900 years after the first steam engine. This one, of course, is science. But
this is nuts.
Bob,
so your consolation is you totally nailed this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first steam engine was a toy. The Aeolipile.
Yeah.
Nah,
yeah.
No clue.
It was a steam turbine created by Heron of Alexandria and described in his Pneumatica in the first century AD.
Oh my God.
It was a sphere with two tubes like through the middle axis, and you would boil water and the steam would come up and it would rotate the sphere. It was the first thing to be made to rotate due to steam power. It absolutely was a steam engine, but it was just a device of curiosity. They could have started the Industrial Revolution 1800 years earlier.
Can you imagine? We'd be
or whatever.
We'd be at Alpha Centauri by now.
Totally, absolutely, they didn't close that loop. They didn't think that this could be made to do work.
Oh my God!
Can you imagine? They did it.
Dopes,
those bastards.
Insight, then comes action, the other way around. Right.
As we say in our book, you couldn't even predict the present. You know what I mean? Like you couldn't go back in time and predict how things would have happened because somebody could have decided that the steam engine was a tool 2,000 freaking years ago. The first firearm, and Kara, you were all over this one. Firearm is a very specific term here. it isn't what we would call a gun or a rifle or anything. What was the first quote unquote firearm? Anybody know?
No idea.
Give me a country.
A ball in a tube.
China.
It was called the fire lance. The fire lance.
In work.
China, or fire spear. I mean, this is a translation from the Chinese.
It's probably
they invented gunpowder.
Yeah, what Captain Kirk shot at the Gorn.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that. It's a stick. You have like a tube at the end. or a gourd or something. You put gunpowder in there with lead pellets. You aim it at the enemy like you did.
Yeah,
the stick
that's
is
a total
in the
firearm.
Yeah, it's a total firearm.
Chemical
it's just
reaction, expanding gases, and a hard propellant. Yeah. That's a firearm.
It's basically a shotgun, but it's on a stick, you know, rather than your then being totally handheld.
But yeah, Evan, that's an interesting point. He said if you don't blow yourself up in the process, yeah. I wonder how consistent they were.
Oh, I'm sure it was deadly. You ever hear, you know, the term hoist on your own petard? You know what a petard is?
No.
A petard is an explosive device. And so they were so likely to go up on the person doing it, right? So it basically means that you got blown up by your own bomb. That's what that means. Yeah, hoist on your own petard. So I remember that because we used the word petard to refer to primitive guns in our LARP. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. So, I do remember that too.
Yeah. Wish so this is like, they're both older than you think, but the steam engine was much older, you know, than the first firearm. The first firearm was around the 10th century. The first steam engine was the first century. So that one is science, but it totally mixed up in your head. So I really like this one because again, it forces you to think about about how far in the past were these certain things. And it's especially with technology, technology always has far deeper roots than you think. Always. Like when you start to think about, when you start to look at the history of it.
Oh yeah.
Everything is like, and this, like the first thing like this was always like 1,000 years before you thought it was, you know, like it always was much longer in the past.
How about what we discovered, Steve? Like the boat? The boat was invented not even by Homo sapiens?
Yeah, right. There, maybe not. Maybe it wasn't even Homo sapiens.
Another primate made a boat.
When I was researching this, I came upon the steam engine one. I'm like, I'm 100% using this because that's going to throw some of the guys. But I had to come up with something that was invented later than you thought, right? And that was hard. It was really, I really couldn't do it. So my firearm was late enough. But
yeah.
I was trying to come up with something that was invented later than you might think. And the closest I could come, but it was too complicated to make a clean statement out of it, was the horse-drawn carriage.
Oh.
The horse-drawn coach is really like a very late, like 15th century introduction. Yeah, it's really Renaissance. So, but the thing is, anyway, it's difficult because, you know, you start to get into the details of like what's a coach versus a carriage and like a coach, it has to be covered and it has four posts. You know, that's the thing you get into like a car. But carriages could be covered. But anyway, it was too complicated to make a clean item out of it. And then what were they using it for? Like the Romans used covered carriages for military things, or they had two-wheeled chariots. There's so many permutations. I couldn't figure out a way to make it clean, so I rejected it. But it was interesting, though, that you think of like the horse-drawn coach, like the coach getting in a coach. That was a relatively late introduction, much later than I thought. And do you know why it was so late? This is very interesting.
Mm. Horse-drawn coach was so late.
Because roads were shite. That's why. Because roads were so bad. And I don't know if you guys have ever ridden on a cobblestone.
How bad were they?
They were terrible. That if you were in anything. So riding a horse, you can kind of go along with the bouncing of the horse. But if you were in a carriage that did not have good suspension, you would be bouncing all over the place.
You'd be injured.
Yeah, you'd be injured. Even like just we took a horse-drawn carriage on a cobblestone road in Vienna. And that was intolerable. Like, I mean, it was like, how did people do this?
How did they?
And that was actually a high tech road for the, you know, for the time.
I've seen good suspension on carriages. That must have been a late development.
Yeah, that was the key technology. So it started as leather, right? They were just suspended by leather, and that has a little bit of give. And then later on, steel springs were added.
Yeah, steel springs.
That's when they became
steel. Not bronze springs.
Yeah. Well. Bronze is not springy like steel is. That's definitely true. Okay.
Things we all find interesting are very different. From yes. I have to say, I know you want to end. But I have to say, this reminds me so much of like those fun, because we're so bad at time scale and like it reminds me of those fun things where it's like, you know, Triceratops lived closer in time to us,
Cleopatra or whatever,
than to Stegosaurus.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Cleopatra lived closer in time to the iPod than the pyramids were built.
Right, that's the one, yeah.
Like,
I love that
and
one.
And that's like blows people's minds when they think about it, but it's just math.
Who's Amber Heard?
Evan, give us a quote.
With less critical thinking comes more vaccine hesitancy. That was a headline written by Nedra Roan. She's a columnist with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And it's one of those cases where, yeah, you can read the headline and and be satisfied that it's accurate. So
yeah,
I like
that's a
it.
Deceptively complicated statement, though, because as a science communicator, the first thing I think of, is it though? I do think that you have to think about that, because not all problems, not all belief in pseudoscience is a knowledge deficit problem. Not right. all of it is a critical thinking deficit right. problem either, but some things are knowledge deficit. Vaccine hesitancy is a critical thinking deficit problem, but it's also an issue of conspiracy thinking and identity. And so it is more complicated than that, but I do think there's a core of critical thinking in there. I do agree with that, but deceptively complicated little statement. Actually.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, it's been a fun episode. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
You got it, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.